Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Finally today, we want to share with you a recent conversation we had with Deborah Kramer. She lives in Gloucester, and she's author of a new book called The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey. The bird is the red knot, a small shorebird that weighs less than a coffee cup. The ancient crab is the horseshoe crab, a creature that's lived basically unchanged on this earth for 450 million years. The two animals are intimately connected, and human beings are interfering with that connection, and we talked with Deborah about that. But first, we thought we'd start with the third part of this story, the epic journey. Because each year, the little red knot takes wing on an astonishing migration, an almost 20,000-mile round-trip journey from the southern tip of Argentina, north to the Arctic, then back. Deborah Kramer followed the birds, so before we jump into the rest of our conversation, let's just listen to Deborah and imagine in our mind's eyes the fantastic flight of the red knot, beginning in Tierra del Fuego.
It's a remote beach on the Strait of Magellan. There's about 64-mile length of beach, and the tide goes out about 7 miles. It's the only place where I've ever stood at the edge of the sea at low tide and not been able to see the water. We waited and waited, and then in the distance we could see what looked like a whiff of smoke. I actually did think it was smoke. And then as the tide came in, the birds started coming in with the tide, and the whiff of smoke got bigger and bigger and bigger, and it was thousands of shorebirds coming in to eat with the tide. It was beautiful. From there, some of them go to a place called Las Grutas in Argentina. It's a developing resort, so the birds are competing for space on the beach with a lot of bathers, ATVs. Some of those beaches are very crowded.
Right.
I also visited them in the Laguna Madre of Texas, which is one of the most heavily human-designed bodies of water around, and yet there are birds there.
So in my mind's eye, I'm sort of seeing the map of the world, the Western Hemisphere, from the Arctic to the United States, Central America, and South America, and I'm trying to draw that little dotted line that the birds follow.
Right, and well, then you would continue up to James Bay, and then up to a little island called Southampton Island, just below the Arctic Circle. And there was a tiny bird in Delaware Bay at the same time I was, and this bird beat me up to the Arctic. It apparently flew through a major storm that grounded all of us on Baffin Island, where we waited and waited and waited so the bush pilots could fly us in, because it was so overcast and snowing so hard that the pilots couldn't tell where the ground was and where the clouds were. So we stayed in Baffin Island while this bird navigated this.
Was somehow. It tagged? Is that how you knew?
Yes, okay. It had a little tag on it with a number.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the other thing about it was freezing up there. And the birds were walking around in the snow, and we were all wearing every single piece of clothing we had.
And still feeling very
and
cold.
And still feeling very cold.
The hardy little red knot. From Argentina to the Arctic, almost 20,000 miles there and back again. Flying across continents and through blizzards, you can imagine how tough their journey is. Deborah Kramer says that's why, about 3/4 of the way into their northerly migration, the red knots make a very important stop, Delaware Bay. And they time it perfectly. Once a year, in late spring, when the water warms, at high tide during the full and new moons, hundreds of thousands of ancient horseshoe crabs crawl ashore to lay their eggs. And in an astonishing act of synchronicity that's been going on for thousands of years, this is when the red knots arrive, to eat the eggs, fatten up, and power north to the Arctic.
And one night I went out. It was a full moon night. Otherwise, it was very dark. And it was about 12 o'clock, I think. I went out onto this beach, and there was nobody else there. And the beach is completely quiet. I was there, I don't know, probably about 20 minutes, 25 minutes before high tide. And then the crabs started coming in, thousands of them. So you could stand on the beach, and in either direction, as far as you can see, they're all lined up with the tide coming in. And they're laying their eggs in the sand, and then they go back. And 30 minutes after high tide, they're gone. So if you come an hour earlier or an hour later, you miss the entire thing. Then the next day, I went to another beach, which was covered with shorebirds, thousands of them, scurrying around as fast as they possibly could. They were thin, they were hungry, and they were in a hurry. But there were so many of them that you couldn't even see the sand.
So you can see just how closely the red knots, and many other shorebirds for that matter, are connected to the horseshoe crab. They come together, down from the sky and up from the water, just once a year. The crabs lay their eggs. The birds eat just what they need. Then they go their separate ways. And as we said, this has been happening for thousands of years. Deborah Kramer says the delicate balance, though, it's at risk because of, you guessed it, us, human interference.
Horseshoe crabs are incredibly resilient animals, and there's always been quite a few of them. But humans have always had an interest in horseshoe crabs. In the second half of the 19th century, they took millions of them out of the water and turned them into fertilizer and managed to deplete large numbers of them. Synthetic fertilizers came in, and then the crabs recovered. What's happened more recently is that there's been a growing interest in using horseshoe crabs for bait. Mm. This is unnecessary for a number of reasons, but that depressed the number of horseshoe crabs substantially, so that the birds, usually 90% of them, would gain the weight they needed to get to the Arctic and successfully breed. In around, by 2002, I think only a third of them were.
Wow.
So the population started dropping, and a number of people who were watching the birds and advocating for the protection of the birds figured out that it was the horseshoe crab that actually needed to be protected in order to protect the bird. And that started years of regulation, which may or may not be adequate even now.
Hmm. Every horseshoe crab that's caught for bait dies, right?
Right.
So obviously that's had a profound impact on the population. But there's also another
use.
Remarkable use for the crabs that science has found.
The crab is an amazing animal. In the 1950s, a scientist discovered that horseshoe crab blood clots in the presence of toxins that are released by certain kinds of bacteria. It took many years to isolate that quality and turn it into a test which was approved by the FDA that basically looks for those toxins in all the vaccines that we have, all of the IV antibiotics that we have, chemotherapies that we have, any drugs that are administered into the bloodstream, the 500,000 heart stents that are implanted in people every year, hip replacements, knee replacements, all of these things don't give us raging infections because the horseshoe crab blood test makes sure that they don't have any endotoxin on them.
So, Deborah, what you're saying is millions of people, anyone who's had a vaccine, a stent, an IV, have the horseshoe crab to thank for the cleanliness or sterility of what's been put into their bodies.
And I would say your pets as well.
Okay. But we should say, though, that unlike the horseshoe crabs who are caught for bait, all of them die. The mortality rate for horseshoe crabs that are taken for this product is significantly less, right?
It is significantly less. The regulators are assuming that 15% of them die. There are some studies which show it's actually closer to 20 or 25%.
You know, as a rule, I really shouldn't give my opinion on things, but I am going to give my opinion on this, that it astonishes me that this 400-million-year-old creature, this ancient being, is still the primary source of this cutting-edge biomedical process equipment. I don't know what we're going to call it, but the reality of that is amazing to me.
Well, this animal, when you think about it, is amazingly resilient. There have been 5 mass extinctions on this planet, and the horseshoe crab has survived all of them, including the one that killed 97% of marine life. And I'm not surprised in some ways that we haven't been able to replicate it. This is a unique animal that deserves an amazing amount of reverence and respect.
Why does understanding the relationship between these two animals, why does it matter to us?
There are utilitarian reasons why we would like to keep all these animals here. One of them has to do with the LAL test that the horseshoe crab provides us. For the birds, I think that it's very difficult for us to make economic analysis of what is valuable and what isn't valuable. I don't think that we can really anticipate what the losses are going to be, yet over and over again, we start feeling consequences when we wipe out birds. Mm. And the book has lots of examples of those. There are millions and millions of birds, and they add a great deal of beauty to our lives, and I think they would be diminished if they were gone.
Just in hearing you describe the beauty that you feel birds provide to our lives, I just can't help but to think of the fact that after the winter we had and spring finally getting here, it is such a joy to hear the birds sing again.
It is.
I mean, that's just like the most tiny way in which they enrich our lives, but I can palpably feel it right now.
Well, it's the singing, and you would like to go to the Arctic because the Arctic is very quiet. There's nothing to hear up there except the wind and the cracking of ice, and the polar bears are pretty quiet. As spring comes, the air is filled with the singing of birds. It's truly a beautiful, beautiful thing.
So you also call the red knot a 21st century canary in the coal mine. What could it be ringing the alarm for?
They make this long journey. They're taking the measure of the edge of 2 whole continents, because how they manage in one place is affected by whether their lives are diminished or enhanced in another. So when they're all done, we have a sense of the health of the edge of these 2 continents. How well they can thrive there has implications for us, even if it's not directly related to the birds themselves. So, for example, we've talked about how they need the crabs and we need the crabs. The birds also eat clams and mussels in other places along the route. We eat a lot of shellfish, and all of these shellfish are going to be threatened. They're already being threatened by the increasing acidification of the ocean. Thirdly, their homes at the edge of the sea are getting eroded away. The sea's going to come in. We aren't going to really be able to stop it.
Ever more every year.
Right.
Well.
And if the edge of the sea is a healthy place for them, it can be a healthy place for us.
Well, on that note, Deborah, before I let you go, there's one more thing I really have to ask. Because you live in Gloucester, right?
Yes.
After taking this epic journey with the Red Knot, did it make you look around Gloucester or Cape Ann differently?
Of course.
How so?
It's almost embarrassing to say this, but I've lived along the marshes of Gloucester for a long time now, and I've spent years out there on Cranes Beach, and I have to say, I never saw these birds. So I came home, and we went out early one September, and we paddled out to a little stand of marsh grass, and we walked along the mud and stood behind the grass, and on the other side, the water was coming up and the birds were coming in. And there were several juvenile red knots. They'd been up in the Arctic when I was there, and they were on their way to Cerro del Fuego, and there they were in my backyard.
Amazing. Well, Deborah Kramer's new book is The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. Deborah, thank you so much.
Magna, thank you.
Kramer's new book is out next week, but we have an excerpt of it now, along with beautiful photographs of her epic journey. It's at our website, radioboston.org. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney. We've also had assistance today from Allison Bruzak and Jake Lucas. Tim Skog is our technical director. Got some able help from James Francis Trout. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a wonderful weekend, and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.